Most of you get onto drugs.
Most of you. I guess almost all of you. Because of acceptance. Peer pressure. Right? Because you wanted to imitate the older kids, right? You wanted to be accepted by them.
This is Art Barker in footage from the documentary Seed of Hope from WTVJ in Miami in the early 1970s. What you can't see unless you jump on YouTube is the room full of eager kids waiting to answer him, and Barker with his halo of receding hair and, well, carny vibe.
Okay.
Every drug epidemic has its hucksters, and during the heroin epidemic in the late 60s and early 70s, it had Art Barker. Barker's claim to fame evolved out of a career as a failed nightclub comic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. As an anti-drug crusader in South Florida, he established a treatment system for teens. He called it the Seed.
How many of you sold drugs to kids younger than you were? So all kids then who use drugs sell drugs. True? Okay, good.
Overly worried parents loved Art Barker, and so did judges, and so did the federal government, at least for a while. But it's hard to imagine, especially since his idea of drug treatment was taking in kids who might have been addicted to nothing more than Pink Floyd albums, and screaming at them all day until they finally broke down. But Barker's invention has proved a lasting one. He basically started what reporter Maya Salovitz has dubbed the troubled teen industry. Soon after Seed shut down, there was, of course, another to take its place, and that one was called Straight Incorporated. His legacy of using humiliation as a form of drug treatment for adolescents can still be felt today. It's used in facilities all across the country. I'm Jason Cherkis for The Huffington Post. In this feature, you'll hear from some of the kids who survived both Seed and Straight Inc., what the programs were like through their eyes, and more importantly, what happened after they left.
Okay, here I go. I'm Mark Polonsky. I'm 56 years old. In 1972, I was 14, and I was I call myself a bit of a nerd. You know, I was definitely an intellectual kid. I was not, I was a little bit socially awkward.
According to Mark Polonsky's self-description, he doesn't fit the stereotype of a troubled youth.
I read constantly. In fact, I'd get busted for reading in class. You know, if I was too bored. And I was a big chess fan. I played chess after school. I was in the chess club. And, I basically loved school at that point. My report card right before I was put in the Seed was, I remember, it was 3 A's and 3 B's. And I wanted to do better.
But because of his curiosity, or perhaps some drama associated with his teenage years, his parents put him at the Seed. Mark describes the early stages of the program where new initiates were called newcomers. And when they enter the program, the seasoned older kids, called oldcomers, dictated every part of a newcomer's new world.
The first phase is when you're a newcomer living away from home. And during that phase, you are you're never allowed to be alone. You can't even go to the bathroom alone. And, you know, you are, you know, taken to the home of somebody, normally someone who's a little bit older, who's farther along in the program, and they kind of work on you at night when you're not in the group during the day, and you know, you're chronically sleep deprived. I certainly was. I mean, my old comer, so to speak, really kept sleep. I mean, sleep was sort of the, I don't know if you call it the carrot at the end of the stick or something, that, you know, if he would let me sleep if I admitted certain things or if I did my so-called moral inventory correctly. Pretty much all the kids were sleep deprived. In the group, you know, kids would be falling asleep, but we had to slap each other awake. You know, the rule was whenever somebody was falling asleep, they were just copping out of the wrap, and you didn't really need as much sleep as you thought you did. So we were all kind of like zombies.
Why do you like to have everybody tell you what to do and have everybody make your decisions for you?
Here's one of the rap sessions where a newcomer would be stood up and then broken down by kids further along in the program.
You're going to put forth some effort. So why do you like to have everybody pat you on the back and tell you that you're doing so good and make all your decisions for you? Why do you do these? Why do you play this game? Start working towards becoming a man. make some of your own decisions. And the first one you got to make is that you want to get straight.
Are you afraid of going to college and making something out of yourself instead of serving all that time you've got hanging over your head? Hey, man, look at what you've got here. Look what everybody else here has. Look what I'm going to be. Because I got up off my ass and did something. Hey, I don't have to stick a needle in my arm anymore. I'm going to be a psychologist, and I'm going to help people like you. And I'm going to be something, and people are going to look up to me. Are you afraid of that, Barry? Are you afraid you're going to be happy? And you're going to take your share of busting your ass, because everybody else is doing it.
Art Barker didn't attend all the sessions, but he remained a towering presence. Here's Mark again.
See your Art Barker at all during these episodes?
Yeah, he'd come in and, you know, everybody would scream, love you, Art, and he'd like, you know, he'd trumpet about how we're all going to, you know, they're trying to stop the seed, but we're going to save kids, screw you, everybody, and everybody would like, you know, he'd be like the rock star coming in.
Most of the things that we're teaching here, you're trying to teach the kids in the school systems, you're trying to teach them in church. We're able to do it here because of the phenomenal peer pressure that we have going for us. This is the only kind of a program that's going to work for these kids. They got onto drugs because of peer pressure. They're getting off drugs, peer pressure.
He was, you know, I mean, he was full of himself. He seemed very, in the way he seemed detached from reality, and I think he really was. Art Barker, I mean, he was crude. You know, he liked the adulation and attention. He would make crude jokes. You know, he would, like, sing his own version of the Big Rock Candy Mountain or something. You know, he was basically a showman.
I remember he was kind of a short fella, maybe balding. He seemed very...
This is Patty Payne. She first entered Seed in 1971.
Very charismatic and very powerful. So when Art Barker walked in the room, we all had to get real excited, and usually they would prompt us before he came in the room to start, like, clapping and getting, like, all happy. We were all yelling, I love you, Art, I love you, Art, and it was just like some godlike person walking in that we adored and worshipped.
She described herself to me as a typical 14-year-old at the time. She enjoyed hanging out with friends and experimented a little bit with smoking pot.
My mom didn't like the kids I was hanging around with, and my mom didn't like the way I chose to dress, which was a pair of boots that evidently she had a problem with. She found out, or she heard in a conversation, that I had smoked pot, and that was true. I had experimented with smoking pot, and I didn't like it. I still liked my friends, I still liked those people, but I did not like smoking pot, and I didn't intend to keep smoking pot. So she sort of intercepted, before it even became a problem, she and my father told me they were going to take me, I think they were going to take me out to lunch or something, and we pulled into this parking lot, and it was just a huge brick warehouse building, and it had a chain link fence around it. But I had no idea what the seed was. I hadn't heard of it, and I didn't know I was going to be left there. I was just so confused. I was young. I was confused. I was a shy girl, and I was very much a people pleaser, and I was just trying to be, you know, like, agreeable. And next thing I know, my parents say goodbye to me, and I started to cry, like, wait, what's going on? And then they, some girl held my hand and brought me into the big, huge warehouse. And I had to sit in the front row, totally dazed and confused, like, what just happened?
And then how did you feel that first night there? I mean, when you were with your Seed foster parents?
Well, so that was horrifying. So, like, at the end of the night, I mean, this program started at 10 in the morning and it went till 10 at night. And so they called out my name, and I stood up, and they called out another girl's name, and she came and took my hand. And she brought me to her car. So we're driving home. I have no clothes. I have nothing but what I'm wearing. And we go to this house. And I think I just went right into this protective mode. Like, I shut down and just tried to, like, figure out, what do I need to do to survive this? Because it was like, I had no idea where I was. I had never seen these people before. I didn't know what the next day was going to bring. And I don't remember sleeping. I don't remember, like, being able to take care of my bodily needs, like being able to go to the bathroom properly, brush my teeth, any of it. It was just like, I felt like I was being held captive, but I couldn't figure out why. The whole thing for me was about surviving it, and I would be like a chameleon and behave however I felt like I had to just to survive so I could get to the next phase that I could eventually go home. So I was willing to do anything, including lie about drugs that I had or had not taken just to play the game to get out of there.
We'll hear more from Patty a little later and from her mom about her thoughts on the Seed. But first, the story of Straight Incorporated, the program that Seed became.
My name's Marcus Chatfield. I'm 45 years old, and I was in Straight Incorporated from 1985 to 1987. At the Springfield, Virginia facility.
Straight Inc. had the same basic philosophy as Seed. Hours on end of peer pressure-based treatment, if it could be called that. Here is Marcus describing the scene.
Overwhelming. You're introduced into a world that you had no idea anything like that could ever exist anywhere. The building was a warehouse. Kind of an industrial area of town, and inside the warehouse is just a big, giant, bare room with nothing but chairs in these straight rows of kids sitting in these chairs, flapping their arms over their head so they can stand up one at a time and talk about how horrible they were as kids before they were in the program and how grateful they are to be in there. So the whole day is you sitting in a chair, flapping your arms. Someone gets called on randomly, and it could be you. And they talk about their past, how horrible they were. They sit down. Everybody flaps their arms again. While you're flapping your arms, you're preparing to be called on because you have to be ready to talk if you do get called on. So it was very monotonous. It was hypnotic. It was confrontational. It was physically painful because you are sitting in a chair all day long. You know, nobody was getting enough sleep. Nobody was getting enough food or water or any sunlight or any other diversion from this daily practice. And almost impossible to describe how it feels to be subjected to that life for 12 hours a day.
It's overwhelming when you come in there. I mean, you don't know what's going on. There are people flapping their arms around. The chairs are always shrieking. People are being stood up and screamed at. So after 2 weeks, you really feel like, you know, God, I've done something pretty inhuman just doing this for 2 weeks.
This is Sarah Martinez. She first entered Straight in 1987 and didn't leave until early 1989. Sarah was told at the beginning that she would only have to stay for 2 weeks. After that, she could decide to withdraw from the program. But here's how she described it.
And then I put my hand up. You're supposed to sit in there with your back straight up, your hands on your knees, and your hand with your palm flat, and your thumb up, sitting, you know, straight out with a little paper in there that says you want to withdraw. And I can't remember if I was brought into a room when they told me this. I must have been, but I remember them telling me that my parents weren't going to let me out, and it was up to my parents, and so I was not going to be able to withdraw. And so it was probably about a week after that that I tried to run away, or within a week, the first time.
Sarah was in a car with her oldcomer when she bolted. She ran through a suburban neighborhood until her oldcomer finally caught up with her after several blocks. When she returned to the group rap sessions, she faced the consequences.
I was basically against a wall and had just one girl after another screaming, and the spit would come flying out of their mouth, and their faces would turn red, and their lips, it was so intimate. You could really see everything about their mouth, screaming what a disappointment I was and how could I do this, and, you know, on and on and on. And then from that, once you're stood up and screamed at like that, then you really have a good sense of what's at stake. You know, until then, it's somebody else that did something wrong.
Sarah Martinez's parents threatened her with straight several times, saying that if she didn't shape up, they were going to send her there. Based on the other programs she had been exposed to, Sarah says Straight's methods were by far the most inhumane.
I mean, you expect there to be a certain level of respect, you know, because the other places I'd been in, you still have your own room, you can shower without being watched, you can go to the bathroom without being watched, you can, you know, you still have rights, you can talk to people on the outside. Straight was like dealing with insane people. I mean, you just, all the time, you just have to check yourself and go, wow, I didn't think anybody in charge could do something like that. You know, I mean, it's just kind of, I don't know how to explain it, but this sense of almost wonder at it all, you know, that they can even do this, like that they cannot let you talk to your parents, that they cannot let you talk to your friends or call people or listen to music or read. I mean, they wouldn't even let you read. So it was all these things that it was just like, wow, or not being able to have your shoes in the same room, you know, and then just the screaming and the fact that you could wet your pants and sit there and somebody wouldn't let you get up to go to group or to let you out of group to go to the bathroom.
Did that happen to you?
Yeah, that did. I don't know how many, but I had several bladder infections. I mean, it was probably just the same one over and over.
Marcus detailed how bad the abuse could get and how it could become physical in an instant.
In Straight, there was a million rules, and if you didn't follow the rule wholeheartedly, you could be punished. And if you weren't participating with enough zest, you could be punished. And if you outright resisted, if you outright expressed, you know, that you didn't want to be there, if you didn't participate, you would be forced to participate. So if you didn't want to flap your hands and your arms, if you didn't want to flap your whole body to get called on, the people next to you would flap your arms for you. And if you resisted at all, they were obligated to pin you to the floor. And it would be five people against the misbehavior. So one person on each limb, and then someone holding your head and holding their hand over your mouth if you tried to speak. So the physical violence was every day. Somebody was getting restrained, and some days it was a lot of people.
In 1984, 60 Minutes did an expose on Straight Incorporated. They went around the country tracking down former members who talked about being physically restrained as a form of punishment.
What would happen in cases where someone didn't follow their rules of behavior?
Okay. This happened a lot. Somebody wouldn't sit up straight enough. They weren't motivating, waving their hands fast enough. They would be sat on. That was the first form of punishment, is they would take you out of group. They'd lay you down the side of group in three or four phases, which is on your chest, your face, and all your arms.
They had a girl on each part of my body. Every part of my body, there wasn't one piece of skin except for my face showing, sit on me for about 2 hours. And by then, I felt like I'd just given up. I thought that I was going to die, you know. And it's like that's how they think they're going to break you into doing something.
When they sat on me, I felt like I was going to die. I couldn't breathe or anything like that, you know. And in a way, I wanted to die so that they would, you know, have to pay for it and stuff like that. And I just wanted to get out of there. I didn't think I was ever going to get out.
Here's Marcus Chatfield again.
You're exhausted, you know, because you get 5 hours of sleep every night, you know. Well, if your eyelids droop, people next to you are going to hold your eyelids open, you know. If you get restrained and stood up and people are screaming at you for being, you know, a piece of shit druggie who, you know, if you're getting screamed at and you close your eyes because you don't want to get spit in your eyes, well, they'll hold your eyes open, you know. It was total control. And just witnessing that was traumatic, you know. Just witnessing the abuse of others, because you couldn't do anything to stop it. If you tried to stop it, you would be, you know, your torture would increase, you know. And it took several days for it to really dawn on me that this was the treatment. You know, I thought I'd be going to get help with, like, life skills. Like, maybe I'd learn a hobby, you know, or maybe a tutor, you know, maybe some family counseling where we could really talk about our problems, but it wasn't like that. The treatment was sitting in this chair with 200 other kids, flapping my arms all day and watching the violence that took place against the kids that didn't want to follow the rules.
Coming up, the parents that put their children in these programs and the hysteria around the drug war that sustained enrollment in both Seed and Strait.
There was a big drug craze going on at the time. All the parents were terrified that their kids were on drugs.
My name is Joan Payne, and I'm 84 years old.
And when Seed first came around, I guess, how many children did you put place in Seed at the time?
Patty went first, and then Mary, so that's two girls. That's it, only two girls. Okay. Kathy too. Three girls, sorry.
And I guess, how did you first hear about Seed, and what made you decide to place your girls in there?
Well, Patty, my youngest girl, who you interviewed, went away with her father for the weekend. And when she was gone, I don't know why, but I suspected, you know, her attitude had changed a lot. So I went through some of her pockets, and I found a strange cigarette and some other stuff. I really didn't know too much about pot, so my other kids told me what it was. So I was very upset, and I went to a priest. And this was in Hollywood, Florida. And he is the one that told me about the Seed.
Patty's mom was a true believer, and to this day still feels the Seed was a positive impact on her daughter's lives.
What was your impression when you would go to Seed, and I think there was these open meetings where parents could go, and what were they like? What do you remember from them?
I was absolutely relieved. My prayers were answered. I can't remember their names. Do you remember their names?
There was Art Barker. Did you ever talk to him?
Oh, Art Barker, yes. And then what was her name, his wife?
I do not remember his wife's name.
Oh, she was a doll. And all the girls that were there, all the girls that were counselors, they were just wonderful.
What was Art like?
What, Art?
Yeah, what was he like?
He was such a gentle soul. He didn't hide from anybody. He was out in the open. He was like the uncle that I would want Patty to be with. You know, he felt like I was very comfortable with him. He was he smiled. He was very pleasant. He wasn't gruff at all. They ran the Seed. He and his wife were just the epitome of where I would like my daughter to be. It was all family oriented. The open meetings, we made so many friends. I cooked too. I cooked because that's who did the cooking. All the families did the cooking. So I cooked. I drove people back and forth. Patty had newcomers stay at the house. It was a whole new beginning for me. My eyes were open to, other people. I couldn't be any happier with her there, being protected. I was just afraid of what Patty was into. I couldn't even bring Patty to get a pair of shoes. She would have gotten those over boots, those big construction boots. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want my daughter walking out of the house, with construction boots on. And it was just her, the way she dressed, the way she talked to you. It wasn't a pleasant picture. And I didn't like that.
Joan Payne's sentiments were common for parents of street and straight kids at the time. But as more was learned, as more lawsuits were filed, as more state investigators got curious, more parents began to second-guess their decision to send their kids there in the first place.
It was very strange. It was like a cult. Now, my name is Donald Schilling.
This is Don Schilling.
And I'm age 65.
His daughter went into straight in the mid-80s.
I think it was about 1984, 85.
The place instantly freaked him out.
That's kind of how I can explain it. It was like a cult. They were all kind of sucked into this belief that this place was like the panacea and it was going to cure their kids of whatever drug addiction they had. And
Dunn was never convinced that straight was necessary, but his ex-wife insisted, and that was that. Over time, though, Dunn became less apathetic and decided to pull his daughter out of the program.
You know, why do you think parents sort of gravitated towards this idea?
After looking back on the whole situation, I just think the parents didn't know what to do, and I don't even know how they found out about straight, but I think that straight kind of made them think that that was the only way that they could get a treatment that really, really worked, and that they had success with a lot of the kids, and that's what my wife was telling me, that they're a very successful program and kept kids off drugs after they were out, and it was monitoring program after that. And I would imagine some of the kids maybe had a drug problem, but I'm not sure, looking back at the whole situation now, that this would be any type of treatment program that would not have an effect on somebody because psychologically, because they're just isolated from everybody.
The 60 Minutes piece featured parents' disillusion with the program as well.
This is a group of parents who withdrew their children from straight because they suspected the staff was abusive. Many of them admit now they probably should have taken their kids out earlier.
And I think it's critical to remember the frame of mind that we as parents were in until we started to really open our eyes. As far as we were concerned, our children were virtually dead anyway, or at least heading straight for the death path.
Because of their use
of drugs? Because of using drugs.
It's difficult to imagine now what the atmosphere among parents was during the drug hysteria of the 70s and 80s. The drug war wasn't just official policy. It was on the nightly news. It was in schools and churches. It was everywhere. When First Lady Nancy Reagan gave a speech at Straight Inc. in Springfield, Virginia, it legitimized the operation in the eyes of many Americans, and it legitimized the hype surrounding teens and drug use. Chris Poole was one of those teens at the facility at the time and remembers just how the visit actually went.
Nancy Reagan gave a speech about how proud she was of all of us kids working on our drug and alcohol problems, which she didn't, what she may or may not have known, most likely didn't know, is that over 90% of us were being held physically against our will, and those that weren't being held physically against our will, we were being held psychologically against our will, brainwashed.
So what did you think when they were there and going through this?
It was a total dog and pony show, and there was Secret Service everywhere, and before they showed up, before the First Lady and Princess Diana showed up, a staff member said to all of us, they said, if you guys pull anything, meaning if you misbehave, if you rebel, if you do anything along those lines, you're going to get an Uzi in your armpit.
Here's Patty's mom again.
When Patty was sort of coming up and growing up and being a 13-year-old, were you also worried because of the time she's 13, there is, across the country, this heroin epidemic with returning Vietnam veterans and this whole thing around heroin. Were you concerned about heroin at all, or was it just the marijuana?
No. I wasn't concerned about alcohol. Is the only thing I was concerned about.
Coming up, life after Seed and Straight. Patty Payne was just a young teen when she first entered the Seed program. And now, years later, she can see the way it's influenced her entire life.
I went through all of my college experience never drinking, never touching anything. Because the fear of God was put in me that I was a druggie, and if I ever did that, you know, that I was a really bad person. So I lost my voice. When I went to the Seed, I learned to say what needed to be said to get the approval of the rap leader or the staff members so I could move on and graduate. And sadly, in the process, I lost my voice. So even all through college, I never raised my hand to ask a question or answer a question for fear I might be wrong or fear I might be ridiculed and people would laugh at me. The Seed part of my life, I tried to block out completely. It's like that didn't happen. The truth is it did happen, and it did affect me significantly. But I don't talk to people about it because I don't think they would understand. I feel like it was like being brainwashed.
After leaving Straight Inc., Sarah Martinez had a hard time adjusting. Every morning she would wake up and just for a moment believe that she was back at that facility.
In the first week I was out, I remember waking up and thinking something's gonna happen. Dad's gonna show up here and he's gonna bring me back or whatever it was. I mean, it's like any kind of hope that you have. The longer you're in there, it just gets pushed farther and farther down until it pretty much just goes away. And that, I'm pretty sure that was sort of the root of that whole thing. I mean, every morning, even, you know, a year later, I would still be waking up. And it was a weird thing, though, because there would also be this insane sense of joy, you know, the longer that I went. So for the first, you know, maybe several months to a year, every single morning, it was the same thing. I'd wake up, oh my God, I'm back in there. Here I am. And then I would notice that, I was in my room and I was not in there. I didn't have any alarms on the doors. And I would sort of revel in that. You know, it was almost like fetishized it or something. And then, the next year and the next year. And it was kind of like every morning I noticed I did that and I knew that I did that. And then I would sort of stop and check in and just sort of marvel at the whole thing. You know, one, that, wow, I'm still doing this. And then I think, you know, maybe 5 years or somewhere around there, I would start going, you know, maybe it'd be halfway through my day and I would think, wow, I didn't do that thinking in the morning. You know, and then, you know, it just seems like it would be longer day, you know, longer chunks of days that I would go without doing that. But I know it was many, many years before I didn't wake up thinking, you know, having that feeling of dread.
The abuse was so real that for some teens, they attempted suicide as a way out. Inside, it could feel like a cruel experiment where emotionally abused kids were forced to physically and emotionally abuse other kids. Here's Marcus Chatfield remembering the time he was forced to berate a young teen.
He was a good kid. He didn't want to be there. I got called on to scream at him, to confront him. And I had nothing, there was nothing I could think of to say And so I just insulted him. I just made fun of his physical appearance. And I had to say something. If I had not confronted him, I would have been started over. I would have been in there who knows how much longer. So, you know, to prevent being punished, I went ahead and off the top of my head, I just started insulting him for how he looked. Not for how, you know, it didn't have anything to do with about his program or if he was, you know, it wasn't. I didn't have anything to say, so I just insulted him for how he looked, you know, and then he's one of many who went on to commit suicide. And, I mean, what do you do with that? I mean, when you're a victim of abuse, but you're also forced to participate in abuse, it also makes you a colluder. I colluded with the enemy. So it's not just this bad thing happened to me. It's I was in this universe where the social currency was the infliction of pain. And I took part in that wholeheartedly so that I could get out of there. And that was my treatment. You know, it's not like I got out of Nazi Hitler Germany and everybody knows that was bad. It's like I got out straight and nobody's ever heard of it, you know.
Yeah, my name is Kelly Matthews. I'm 44 and originally from Northern Virginia, Springfield, Virginia, and now live in Littlestown, Pennsylvania.
This is Kelly Matthews. Her older brother, Steve, was in Strait and one of the many traumatized by the experience. Kelly and Steve were both adopted in the late 60s, and her memories of her brother basically end after elementary school.
Yeah, he loved drawing anything with sea life. Like, he loved sharks. I think he probably would have gone into, like, possibly gone into, you know, marine biology or something like that. He loved the ocean. But mostly animals, I would say. And then sometimes he'd write a story and draw little pictures, you know. But those were, you know, like, I have all his stuff from elementary school. And, you know, he'd always have drawings along with whatever he was writing.
She recalled Steve playing baseball, illustrating stories he'd make up, and his love of the ocean. But there's a reason why our memories end there. Steve was sent to military school, and after a year, he was sent off to Strait.
How old was he when he went into Strait?
He was 15 when he went into Strait.
And what were the, do you remember any of the circumstances as to why he ended up there? Like, what prompted him?
You know, it's confusing for me because they had sent him to military school. And he was there for an entire year. He went to Fort Union Military Academy. 3 weeks after he got home in June, he was in Strait. So I was very confused about that. I asked my mom later, and she said there were a couple things that happened that, you know, caused him to do this. I think it was quite an extreme measure. You know, if he'd done so well for an entire year, you know, it would, yeah. So.
Have you been able to piece together what that was that he had done in those 3 weeks?
I mean, I think she said that he had, like, snuck out and partied or, you know, gotten high or something like that. And, you know, nothing, in my opinion, that warranted that. But, you know, that's easier for me to say now, I'm sure. But she never gave me specifics. I don't even know if she remembers, so.
When he was 18, Steve was finally allowed to withdraw from the program, and did. His parents, though, wouldn't allow him back into the house unless he went to Alcoholics Anonymous. He refused to give in. Steve tried to make it on his own at a time when many of his friends were going off to college. He had a hard time making a go of it.
I ran into him at a gas station in Springfield. He was working there. And I saw him, and, you know, we'd been estranged for so long, and I wanted to go up and give him a hug, and I didn't, you know, so it's one of those, I'd say that's probably my only regret. But we smiled. I mean, it, you know, it was just awkward. And then I think, like, probably a month and a half later, he was dead. So he was, like, living in an abandoned apartment with some friends. But I think the catalyst was the fact that they were all going off to college, and he just felt completely alone, you know. And he ended up checking into a hotel and jumping from a fourth story window. And years later, I got to read his suicide note. I didn't find the note. His best friend Corey had it.
Corey was Steve's friend, and the suicide note was addressed to him.
And I can't regurgitate it word for word, but it basically talks that I'm just a loser, and that, you know, I'm always going to have this problem, and just a lot of negative self-talk, and that he was alone and just didn't, you know, want to be here anymore.
Do you blame the state?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, I could say, well, my parents were to blame, sure, but they wouldn't be to blame if Street didn't exist. Absolutely 100%, I blame Street.
Kelly has since gotten involved in activism around similar drug treatment programs. She's also created a website in the hopes of enlightening parents.
I started getting all these emails from people who were in Street that knew my brother.
Kelly would learn years later about how Steve had rebelled during his entire stint at Straight. To Kelly, it was a revelation. Learning from other Straight veterans about how brave he could be, how he had become this inspirational figure among his Straight peers.
And it was awesome. I mean, it was through that experience I was able to get to know who he had become through, like, the eyes of those that were in there with him. So it was very, very bittersweet.
What did they say about him?
Just that he was awesome, that he was a fighter, he never gave in, he stuck up for people. And that's a tough thing to do in that program, because if you stand up for someone, you know, you're going to probably get abused for it. And, you know, I had one friend, Chris Poole, who emailed me, and he's like, oh, I remember your brother. He reminds me of Cool Hands Luke. He said one time I was, I was getting yelled at because I couldn't motivate because he had sprained his shoulder or something. And they were just ripping him a new one because he wouldn't motivate. And he was probably all upset. And my brother stood up and defended him. He's like, I'll never forget that. You know, so it was just that type of story that really showed me his character. It's just horrific. I mean, what they did is horrific, you know. If they had a responsibility, even if a kid didn't finish, to make sure that child was taken care of, or at least had some type of, you know, but they didn't care. It was a money game, and if they were out to make money.
It was like he went through a war, and then he parachuted back in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, how can thousands of adults now have PTSD? You know, it absolutely was a war. There were prisoners of a drug war, you know. They were affected, and you know, you have to think about, they were affected for years on end as children. You know, their minds were still developing. I mean, this takes it to such another level. And I'm not trying to say war. I mean, we know what hell war is, but these were children, you know, and they couldn't get out of it.
Footage heard in this feature came from the documentary Seed of Hope from WTVJ in Miami and CBS's 60 Minutes. This audio feature was produced and edited by Ibrahim Baki, with technical direction from Brad Shannon. Special thanks to editor Ryan Grimm. For the Huffington Post, I'm Jason Cherkis.